Coffee House Shots is sponsored by EDF, Britain's biggest generator of zero carbon electricity. Find out how we are busy helping Britain achieve net zero at www.edfenergy.com.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth. And we are in the last week of Parliament before we head into the conference recess. James, there's quite a bit lined up, but before we get to social care vote and also the will they, won't they of the second rumour on a reshuffle, we had what appeared to be a bold move by the government over the weekend, which was Sajid Javid saying that the government would not bring in vaccine passports. Tell us what he said and what it actually means.
So it was a U-turn. Boris Johnson had said on the day that all the restrictions lifted that from the end of September, you'd only be able to enter a nightclub if you were double vaccinated. There was huge Tory backbench opposition to this. There was an urgent question in the House of Commons on Wednesday last week where even Nadeem Zahawi, the minister responsible for the policy, said that it kind of went against everything he stood for. And, you know, only one Tory MP spoke in favour of the policy, more than 10 expressed their opposition, and it was clear that there were more than 40 Tory MPs against this. And if Labour were, and the other opposition parties were against it, the government would have lost its majority. So on Sunday morning, Sajid Javid went out, and it sounded at the beginning of his media round like vaccine passports were highly unlikely, and by the end of it they had been ruled out. But I think ruled out for now is the crucial thing to remember, because those who advocate vaccine passports in government, and there are quite a few people who think they are a useful tool, argue essentially that the crucial question is, what do you do if infections start to rise, hospitals begin to become under pressure, and you feel that you need to tap the brake, you need something to act to help? And the view is that in economic terms, vaccine passports are less damaging than social distancing. You know, you can't operate a nightclub with social distancing. You could operate it potentially with a vaccine passport scheme. So I think at the moment is a recognition of how hard they would find it to get it through the House of Commons. But I think if cases were to increase significantly, and then I think that, you know, vaccine passports would come back as an issue, because there are definitely those in government who think they are a tool. But for now, I think the government has backed off, knowing that it could win this fight. And also, I think the case for vaccine passports is less strong, given that there do seem to be more what the Americans call breakthrough infections with the Delta variant than there were with the so-called Kentish one.
And I suppose if we're looking at how the government would get vaccine passports through the Commons, given that there's such widespread opposition at the moment, as you say, Nadeem Zahawi, who I'm sure is delighted he got to go out in the morning round and defend vaccine passports before Sajid Javid got to say they weren't happening and please MPs, to sell it ultimately to MPs, you almost need the situation to deteriorate for there to be more of a justification.
I think it's also worth remembering that the government aren't banning places that want to use vaccine passports from using them. And I think it's an interesting question. You know, for example, we know that Premiership Football has been quite keen to use them on the basis that it assumes that at some point in the autumn or winter, the only way you'll be allowed to kind of carry on with 50,000 people gathering in a stadium, obviously with the fact that that leads to lots of people being in pubs and public transport near the ground, will be if they are all double vaccinated. So it'll be interesting to see if all the places that had talked about using vaccine passports, whether they all back off the idea now that the government has said it won't be compulsory.
And on that winter package, James, we have a situation where there had been various reports which the government didn't suggest was the plan, suggesting potentially a firebreak if cases rocket. There was also the threat of vaccine passports all through the summer. But now it feels, as we're getting to the point where the government unveil its winter plan, if anything, it's about easing things more rather than tightening things. So you have the booster jabs, which seems to be the idea of where the government believes is most important, and that's what's going to get the country through the winter. But in terms of everything else, we're hearing PCR tests might be ditched if you're travelling back from abroad. It doesn't really feel as though the government's too worried about the autumn if you look at the COVID noise.
I think the government is worried about the autumn, but I think it has three big worries. So one is waning immunity. I don't think that booster shots is meant to deal with that. And I mean they are confident that what the JCVI will recommend on that will be quite broad, while as up to now it's been relatively limited. Only so far they're only actively recommending it for people with suppressed immune systems. The second thing I think they still worry about are those 6 million unvaccinated people what they intend to do there. I mean, I think the third thing they worry about is a very bad flu season, because there's less natural immunity because so many people have been in lockdown. And also it's thought that the flu vaccine this year won't be particularly effective. But I think one of the consolations is for the government is that people's behaviour has turned out to be fairly self-regulating. So when COVID cases go up, people are more inclined to stay home. And if you look at London Transport, for example, the week after all the restrictions eased, the so-called Freedom Day, July the 19th, there were fewer people on London Transport than there were before. I mean, that, and the thinking goes, that's what, because cases were high and people wished to avoid the risk of picking up the virus. I think the one question, though, which I have is, how much of that restraint was because people were worried about getting pinged? And now that the rules, you know, now that you don't legally have to self-isolate if you are, you only legally have to self-isolate if you actually yourself test positive, whether people will be a bit more gung-ho.
And James, while the government's mood music when it comes to COVID will cheer MPs, at least in the short term, with the temporary axing of vaccine passports, one vote that is going to be less easy to sell is on social care and the NHS levy that was unveiled last week. It had support broadly if you look at votes of the party, but it does feel as though over the weekend things have got worse rather than better for the government. Is that down to a series of polls suggesting the Tories are now level pegging, or we've also had a leaked analysis and warning of the dangers this policy can do?
I think it is. I still would be very surprised if this policy didn't get through. I mean, there are two things, though. I mean, obviously, the polls have had an effect on the mood music. It shows that, you know, that the public have noticed the policy and don't like the breaking of a manifesto commitment, though. I think it's an interesting question how much of a slide is about the tax rise, how much is about the ditching of a triple lock. Fraser and I, and you discussed this on the podcast on Friday. And then I think the other thing is the flaw in the plan, which is, you know, how do you shift this money from health to social care? It's just becoming more obvious to people. You know, what is the mechanism? You know, and it does seem unlikely that the NHS would willingly give up this amount of extra resource that it's getting. And I mean, that's the other thing driving concern. And then, you know, I think the other issue is it's very hard to see what the road to lower taxes in a smaller state is, because, you know, everywhere you look, all the forces at play are pushing towards bigger government. And I think that, you know, there's a widely trailed Liz Truss speech coming tomorrow, which is expected to kind of warn about this, you know, ever-rising tax burden and what it will do to the UK's economic dynamism. And I think one of the things that worries Tory MPs is it's not just this tax rise. It's the fact that you, in this tax rise, you can see the next tax rise coming, e.g., you know, the levy having to go up to produce some more money for social care because the NHS is, you know, won't release the funds, essentially. And then I think the second worry is, you know, where is the kind of roadmap to how you get to lower taxes and a smaller state? And I think that is the other kind of big philosophical concern.
Now, you mentioned Liz Truss's speech. Tends to be the case that when ministers believe a reshuffle may be imminent, that we see some interesting speeches. We see lots of interviews with ministers, which we've seen quite a lot of recently, and generally people positioning themselves. Now, James, the rumour mill last week said it could be the end of the week. That didn't happen. But now people are saying it could be Wednesday. I think it's worth remembering that Boris Johnson was thinking about a reshuffle before the summer recess. So even though it hasn't happened yet, it's clearly been something that's on his mind. Do you think we could see it this week?
So I think any chief whip would say to any prime minister that you want to reshuffle your government on the last day before Parliament breaks up for a recess, because that means everyone's present, but it gives those people who get the sack or those people who are disappointed, you know, time to go away and lick their wounds rather than kind of instantly going back into Parliament and voting against the government to get something off their chest. Now, as you wrote, Boris Johnson was on the verge of doing a reshuffle when he got pinged because of COVID. So I think, you know, that there is that factor. And you can argue that, you know, that the longer you leave it, the more debilitating it becomes to government. I think that some of the pile-on on Dominic Raab over the summer was undoubtedly about other ministers saying, oh, if he gets demoted or he gets pushed out, that's more room at the top for me. So I think that is a problem. But there's also a question, which is, you know, there's never a good time. So some ministers who don't want to see a reshuffle would argue, look, why would you do this now? The autumn is going to be difficult. We don't quite know what's going to happen with COVID. There are a series of kind of tricky decisions on, you know, which backlogs get dealt with and how quickly, how much money is spent. The spending review will be tough. Why would we create potential extra rebels at this moment in time? Other people say, look, you know, there's never going to be a perfect time to do this. You've got to get on with this. And the longer you leave it, the more out of whack expectations get. So that if you don't end up with an entirely new top team, everyone will think that you've kind of somehow bottled the reshuffle. So I think these debates will go on and, you know, one back and forth. And I think anyone who tells you that they know for certain whether the reshuffle is definitely going to happen or not is wrong, because my strong suspicion is that the Prime Minister doesn't know for certain whether a reshuffle is going to happen or not. You know, he might have views on it, but I think you would be foolish to think that him thinking at this moment, yeah, maybe now is the right time, means it will definitely happen.
And if there is one, that's not too much time for the new Secretary of State to write their conference speeches. Thank you, James, and thank you for listening.